My Life as an Animal, Serialization, Week 2. This episode is brought to you by animalaid.org.uk, who campaign peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promote cruelty-free living.
It's now time to continue our audiobook here on UK Health Radio, My Life as an Animal, written by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith.
My Life as an Animal.
And that's how it went. I didn't lead, but I didn't resist. And most strangely of all, David soon knew what passed between his wife and me, yet remained silent on the subject. He was keen for our burgeoning friendship to carry on burgeoning. He took me to see the then little-known Creedence Clearwater Revival in a bar downtown. And for a while we attempted writing songs together. He seemed easygoing a lot of the time, but unhappiness ran deep inside him. It related to screwy parents and a sister who died very young because of their neglect. The High Ashbury thing was about ditching the rule book, about not being led by your ego, or by a middle-class yearning for respectable mediocrity. But I look back at some of the things I did during that time, things I was part of, and I think, what an awful person that was. Gina's family were originally from Italy. She was wiry and dark-haired, loud, full of passion, and with soulful eyes. I'd been used to dolly birds back in 60s London, but Gina was a grown woman. She thought my accent was cute and also classy. American accents sounded dumb, she said. English accents sounded intelligent. She was full of stuff about women and independence, about how she hated being patronised because she was as smart as any man, and men who tried it could go screw themselves. I later realised that she and a number of other unshackled women I met on Hyatt Street during those days had got a jump on history. So I learnt these things from her, and also how deep the pleasure can be when two people, who are tender with each other, share a bed. The bed itself was just a double mattress on a frame that sat on the floor. Bricks held up a couple of bedside shelves and a brass lamp. The walls between most rooms had been knocked down and replaced with panelled dividers that were usually draped with scarves, towels or dresses. There was no television and just one radio that lived in the kitchen. When her older sister was around, Gina was keen to demonstrate that this Englishman hadn't turned her into a dizzy fool. So she would sometimes speak to me in an abrupt, wounding way. But when Carla was out, the Gina that was warm and had nothing to prove would return. We did simple things, reading in the park, listening to music. When in the mood, she would talk volubly about college in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and a senior tutor, a man of 40 plus, she got to know well and who, between episodes of brilliance, when he'd be issuing epigrammatic one-liners, and quoting Michel Foucault, freedom of conscience entails more danger than authority and despotism, would be drugged up in a mental health facility, suffering with what we now call bipolar disorder. She showed me how to cook some of her favourite, mostly Italian recipes, and I showed her my macaroni cheese special. Every so often, she'd bring home wine. I never asked how she paid her way. After some weeks of intimate tranquility, we began a conversation about how our futures might look. That we were both feeling restless was at last spoken out loud. She wanted some space, and I was ready to pretend to be Jack Kerouac again and hit the road. I had some friends in Los Angeles, about 400 miles south, so I said I might try that. The mood on Hyatt Street was still overwhelmingly communal and optimistic, but a sour note had been sounded lately. More speed was turning up, a substance that experienced hands would warn you to avoid because of the crazed, fearful state it could get you into. But speed was cheap and appealed because of the way it revved your engines. Unlike heroin and methadone, overdosing only rarely killed. For a good number of long hairs who were worn down by their up-all-night whirligig routine, speed was attractive. Equally so for someone keen to dazzle or merely survive the ordeal of being with a lot of people at once, Speed might help in such situations, but take a heap of it, and while you might imagine you came over as irresistibly fascinating, you were more likely to have been the staring eyes one who talked cliches at furious speed without pause. Also more noticeable was the increased number of acid casualties, users of LSD who had taken too much over a long period who were just unlucky. Those could be very damaged people with dementia-like symptoms. Rather than go straight to Los Angeles, I decided to first make the Mexico trip that Kit and I had planned. We talked about eating real tacos and fried beans and cuddling Mexican girls in the back row of local cinemas. In truth, the whole thing about travel is that it scarcely matters where you go. There's always that exhilaration when you're thumbing a lift and a car stops, and you've no idea who'll be in it or how close to your destination you'll be carried. It's the same feeling of lightness when your bus leaves the depot on a 1,000-mile journey, stopping a dozen times through the night to let people off and let others on. I'd get up and stretch almost every time and have coffee every 3 or 4 stops. The toilets, which were fresh at the start of the journey, would be awful at the end, as would I. Dizzy, almost hallucinating, sitting at a coffee counter in a town I'd never heard of at 3:30 a.m., eating blueberry cheesecake. So I'm on my way to Mexico, feeling lightheaded and with dollars in my pocket. I'm feeling rich thanks to an old debtor coming good. Billy was one of the few black faces you'd see around High Street. A tall, lean man of about 28. He was always dressed as though for a downtown office, and seemed always to be in a hurry to get somewhere else. I met him through the boyfriend of Gina's sister, Carla. The boyfriend, called EJ, was also black. He seemed to dote on Carla, though he would never stay in the house beyond a few days. EJ and I got on, and when his friend Billy needed help with some formal letters to prominent Bay Area funding bodies, he turned to Mr. English for help. It seems there was money going spare from white philanthropic bodies, which, whether for tax reasons or because they genuinely had an interest, they were inviting black entrepreneurs and community leaders to bid for. It would be seed funding for projects that would benefit their communities. Billy's motives and what would be done with any funds he'd managed to procure were never clear to me, but I was ready to help him winkle cash out of America, Inc. We worked in an office space in the Fillmore district that was loaned to him. Billy would dictate, describing planned community enriching programs in which he was pivotally involved and which needed urgent seed money. His first spoken drafts were comically overblown with posh white man phrases that he thought would convince his assessors. But we soon settled down, and over 4 or 5 days, we dispatched a couple of dozen bespoke bids to the various Unity funding bodies. I was supposed to be paid on completion of the letters. Then, within various dates that came and went, every time I saw him, he was ready with an excuse, usually someone who owed him money and let him down. But amazingly, after I'd given up on him, he appeared with $165 in cash. I was pleased for me and pleased for him too. "I told you I wouldn't let you down," he said with satisfaction. Mexico disappointed. I went across the border with a guy from Chile who spoke little English, although we laughed a lot and got by with pointing and arm waving. At Guadalajara, a group of young males made me what I thought were friendly gestures when they saw us. They were laughing and coming towards us. A boy in their group, aged about 11, ran at me without warning and kicked me in the balls. Some men in uniform stepped in and it was quickly over. It seems it was my long hair that appalled these machismo males. Within yards of the bus station, there were more signs of macho insecurity. Stores offering remedies, ointments, tonics, shoe lifts, for men worried about their height, their musculature, and penis size. Given what had just passed, there was something inevitable about the way we got thrown out of our hotel after barely an hour. 2 young men together in a room was troubling enough, but it seems they spied on us from an overhead window, and seeing one or both of us naked, ready to shower, thumped on the doors and ordered us out. As it happened, Mail on Mail is not for me. But if the hotel people detested it so much, why did they climb to a loft window and contort and cramp themselves in a position so they might see what they hoped not to see? After calling in on some friends in Los Angeles, I hitched back to San Francisco and telephoned Gina to say that I was back in town. I'd promised I would make such a call. I thought she sounded upbeat, but when I dropped in on her, she was cool and distant. This arrangement we had was not a healthy one. It wasn't making either of us happy. She made up a bed, and in the morning I kissed her, told her how special she was, and we both knew that that was the finish of it. In fact, where it really finished was Century City in Los Angeles, West Side. After leaving Gina, I decided to give LA another go. My money from Billy was all gone, so I hitched down. Being a bounce-back kind of person, I was feeling okay, though a little mournful at the finality of the parting with Gina. The journey to LA took more than 4 days, the final part of it spent in the company of a guy from Florida who was at least 5 years older than me and looked to my eyes like a biker type. His lank, dirty blonde hair kept getting into his eyes, which made him irritable, but otherwise he was subdued. He was keen to make friends. In a way, someone who hasn't got any friends is keen. My instinct was to get away, but I also felt a little sorry for him. An alarm bell rang after he shouted something at a passing police car, and the driver stopped and checked our IDs. My new biker friend, he was called Frank, looked agitated as an officer talked into his radio. After quite a time, he came over, looked searchingly into Frank's eyes, and told us we could go. Soon we were at Digger's shelter. I was drinking coffee and biting into a crusty pie when I heard a commotion at the far end of the room. Frank, I was to learn, had picked an argument with a young black guy, called him ugly names, pulled a knife and threatened him all kinds of harm. Some cool heads arrived and he agreed to leave. I was asked to leave too. My only thought now was, how do I slip away from this violent racist without triggering more madness? I rehearsed some words, but even as I spoke them, they sounded forced. He just said in response, "I understand," and we parted. I rounded back to the Diggers and found shelter at night there for several more days. I must have seen an ad for the Century City cleaning job, and luckily the subcontracting team didn't ask to see any papers. It was a large open-plan space in a towering office block, and our team was allocated 5 or 6 floors. I don't remember all of my tasks, but it involved some bin emptying and dragging a vacuum cleaner across acres of carpet. By the time I started my shift, around 8 p.m, I'd be hungry and got hungrier as the night wore on. On the second night, I risked going through the drawers of 6 desks and blessedly found in one of them a pile of palm-sized chocolate boxes. They were salesman's samples. I felt sordid. I was not a thief, but I ripped one of the boxes open and made short work of the 6 cream and nut-scented chocolates inside. My fellow workers, about 9 or 10 of them, were all black and must have wondered how this white boy landed up here. I joined them during a short break, 2 hours into the shift. They talked quietly, saving their energy, and sipped coffee from flasks. I felt shy and struggled to find something to say. On the second night, the older, grey-haired man of the group looked quizzically at me and asked where my sandwiches were. I said I didn't have any. He gave me one of his, a simple gesture of kindness and generosity that, even today when I think about it, makes me tearful. This man who cleaned offices through the night for a pittance of a wage wasn't a head. He wasn't part of our spiritually advanced, no-rules, ego-free, long-haired community. I doubt that LSD had ever passed his lips. He was a straight. But then, when hitching a ride to Century City for 8 days, before my wages came through and I could afford a bus, the drivers who stopped to give me a lift were not fellow long-hairs. They were invariably straights, in family saloon cars or delivery vehicles. That episode taught me the value of one of the tiredest of all clichés. You can't judge a book by its cover. And nor should you ally yourself with people simply because of the way they look or take against others for the same reason. I would return to California several times in the years that followed, but it was my hippie travels, there goes that word again, that were resonant with meaning. Some of us really did try to describe and even work for a better world, one based on a rejection of war, the embrace of peace and love for our fellows. We left out animals and the immense cruelty visited upon them by our own species. But as well as that, we thought our thoughts far too lightly. We imagined, most of us, that we could stand back and posture virtuously and magic would happen. But the forces that oppress the powerless and take more than their share have to be confronted, and with more than slogans and happy faces.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
Canada, a second chance. I needed some paid work and had a feeling Vancouver would be lucky. I thought of Vancouver, in those days, as a city of wood that had been nailed and hammered together. There were still timber-framed houses on tree-lined roads away from the centre, although a glance in any direction confirmed the speed with which the modern, prefabricated world was shoving aside the old. I phoned my radio DJ friend Cameron, a great on-air giggler, to ask if there were jobs going in his station's newsroom. Cameron's deep mahogany voice was not a thing reserved for his listeners. When staying with him, overnight, it boomed at me across the breakfast table. There were no job vacancies at his station, he said, but the Prince George Recorder had been looking for me, their golden boy of 67, to take on the news editorship of a new Recorder weekend edition. I was soon on the phone to the editor's secretary, who confirmed what Cameron had said, and to save wasting the time it would take me to thumb the hundreds of miles from my current Oregon location to British Columbia, she would arrange for a bus ticket to be waiting for me at the Eugene bus depot. I'd be there by early next morning, I told her, if my hitchhiking lucky streak continued. My last ride that night left me on the side of an unlit road, watching the driver's taillights vanish down a facing track. I was disorientated and stumbled and tripped on half-buried tree roots and knee-high leafy plants. Thorns punctured my hands and legs. I dragged myself up a bank of softish earth and finally found flat, dry ground on which to unroll my sleeping bag. A couple of dozen feet away from me, I could half make out a canopy of leafy branches. Unless there was heavy rain, I would have cover. I'd been asleep a couple of hours when I heard car doors slam and shoe leather racing over gravel. A powerful flashlight beam shone directly into my eyes.
The man directing it was shrieking warnings at me. Then I saw that he was a county police officer and that he'd drawn his gun. A second officer was using a flashlight to scan the area around where I'd set up my sleeping bag. His light lingered on bushes, presumably searching for signs of collaborators. Despite the fretful mood of the officer with the drawn gun, I felt oddly untroubled. Maybe it was my sleepy state combined with the absurdity of the situation. I had thought I'd made my bed in a clearing in the woods, after fighting thorns and choking weeds, but I now saw I was laid out on a recently clipped lawn, barely 30 feet from a conventional suburban two-story house. I told the officers what had happened and that, in mitigation, I was from London, England, but they wouldn't relent. Though it was 1:30 a.m., I was to walk to a bench outside a coffee shop near to where buses going north and south stopped. They gave me directions. I would wait there until an hour after sunrise. If they drove by and found me gone, they'd come looking for me. The Eugene incident was an interesting curtain raiser for what was to follow in Prince George. I'd quit the recorder more than 18 months before and wound up following the hippie trail. While I was away, the myth of the whiz kid journalist from London, me, who could make dazzling magic from something ordinary, came to be believed as fact. As a newspaper man, I was, in truth, less than half-formed, but what I did have and hold on to is a knuckle-down determination to get the job done as best it can be done, and on time. Many of the old recorder crowd, the late-night beer drinkers and storytellers, had moved on. Rick himself looked more like the conventional publisher in search of a good business model than the chaotic creative force I remembered. My work would start in the morning. I was to lead an editorial team of four, with Rick as editor. And although there was far too much to do in the time available, a couple of all-night sessions saw us through. Soon there were lots of flushed, self-contented faces as toast after toast was raised to those who had made the weekend edition breakthrough possible. They included pals and business associates of publisher Rick, and even his older brother Billy, who now lived in Manitoba. My own name wasn't mentioned. For the second issue of the Weekend Supplement, I interviewed a Canadian Indian called Dakota, who was extraordinarily adept at producing functionally reliable cars using what looked to be useless lumps of battered, rusting metal. He had several acres of land a couple of miles out of town on which his auto creations were lined up in formation. He told me that selling any of his cars felt like a betrayal, but keeping them all wasn't possible. He spoke few words, maybe out of shyness, and when words did pass his lips, they were often in the form of gnomic utterances that were illuminating or meaningless, depending on your angle of approach. A typical example was, automobiles have trunks. And there was the equally mysterious, time will tell what time it is. Working with Dakota was a young apprentice of Dutch origin called Thomas. I knew nothing of cars, so was ready to take Thomas's word for it that Dakota's collection, he too wished they could all be kept, was unbelievably special. The oldest were silent movie era black Model A Fords. Those weren't for sale. Many of the others were from the early 1950s. Chevys, Buicks, Studebakers, Oldsmobiles, Pontiacs. They were terminally sick or fully dismembered when Dakota took them on and restored life and movement. Thomas and Dakota together had the languorous way of small-town Western Canada. There was a conviction that if something can be done slowly, then it can be done slower still. I saw them staring at a car forever, talking about one of its tires being flat and pondering what might have caused it. My guitar playing, songwriting and travels sparked an interest in Thomas. He wanted me to teach him new chords and then for us to write songs together. His guitar playing soon overtook my own, but nothing came of the songwriting. Thomas was impressively practical, able to strip a car down and put it back together and do the same with a heater or a radio. But his imaginative faculties slumbered. Neither words nor tunes would come to him. One day he told me of a dream he'd had the previous night, in which he was hungry, and so he went to the fridge, made a cheese sandwich and ate it. I was waiting for the twist, but that was it. Hungry man eats. He carried on working with Dakota, and I pressed on at the recorder for 15 or 16 more weekend specials, at which point I admitted to myself that something was seriously wrong. The heart had gone from publishers Rick's Enterprise. The drive now was almost exclusively for circulation and advertising revenue. Editorial was becoming an afterthought. I found myself plotting a trip to Toronto with Thomas. We'd go in a vintage car that Thomas had bought from Dakota, a 1930s Model A Ford. We'd take the most direct route through BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Ontario, and on arrival in Toronto, sell the story of our marathon journey in a classic vintage Ford to the Toronto Globe and Mail. The weather was good. It was July, so along the way we'd root the forest floor for dried branches that we'd break under a stamped foot. A fire would be started to heat water for tea and to power cooked stews, which we'd keep going and top up with fresh ingredients each night. And that's what we did. We also stopped the car in the middle of a hailstorm in the Manitoba prairies. The weather was raw and wild in a way I've never witnessed. Thomas wanted to get out and risk those golf ball-sized ice stones. I momentarily resisted before giving in. We stepped out together for an exhilarating, terrifying, wonderful few seconds. Then we threw ourselves back into the vehicle and, awestruck, stared silently through the windshield. Being a non-driver, I could best help Thomas by staying awake and watchful to ensure that he didn't slumber at the wheel. The delicious temptation to nod off was strongest crossing the flat, featureless prairie provinces, where for long stretches there were no other roads but the one we were on. In recognition, the Highways Authority added periodic kinks and curves to an otherwise unending stretch ribbon of asphalt. We began worrying about our old A-type's health while still in Manitoba. By the time we crossed into Ontario, Thomas quipped that we were burning more oil than gasoline. Signs for Toronto at last appeared, then signs for the city centre. The Globe and Mail photographer had got to our meeting point near the public library early. My mistake was not asking him for payment before he had us in his sights. He took a number of close-ups, for which we leant on the bodywork and tried to look triumphant. Then he stepped back for medium-range shots, and back again, and one more from here, until it suddenly occurred to us that he'd gone. We had enough for a night in a cheap boarding room, but in the morning, Thomas would have to pawn his box of tools. The rented room was divided in half by a plastic shower curtain. We turned in just after midnight. 90 minutes later, the stranger renting the other half of the room arrived, clumsy with alcohol, and behind his side of the curtain began a very long fidget that sounded like he was putting objects into plastic bags and removing them again, but done very slowly so as not to disturb us. I thought about the heavy tools Thomas never pawned, the anaesthetizing effect they could have on our rustling roommate. The pawning of Thomas's tools the following morning provided us with food and night shelter for several days. During that time, I successfully answered an ad for an assistant editor of a monthly trade magazine called Office Administration. It was 3 years since I'd quit an equivalent two-man post in London so that I could go on my great journey of discovery. Surely I hadn't chased around Canada and the US all this time, taking whatever came my way, only to end up where I began. But no, it wasn't the same. The office in London was based in two gloomy rooms in the old grand buildings by Charing Cross Station. The man who was notionally my editor rarely put in a productive day's work because strong wine has thrown him to the mat and wouldn't let him up. My Canadian editor, Gary, was sober and purposeful, and our work area was not dull, but a large, brightly lit, squared-off work module, one of dozens in the modern office block owned by the powerful McLean Hunter Publishing Company. In those days, it had 200 consumer and business periodicals on the go. Office administration served its readership with equipment, news, and with a digest of novel theories and trials relating to all matters office. The readers, mostly senior managers, wanted to know which wall colourings would get the most out of their employees, what overhead lighting arrangements they should choose, what chair types are the best for keeping staff comfortably at their workstations rather than drifting in search of a stimulation, and so on. Sometimes Gary or I would buy in a piece that addressed one of these wispy, ephemeral topics. Other times I'd be the expert and a thumbprint photo of me would appear alongside my byline. I still had my San Francisco Zabata moustache, which in the context of the publishing world suggested authority rather than rebellion. Gary certainly liked my moustache and decided to grow one as well. But if it was the sophisticated look I was after, my 23-year-old brain assured me that I had to acquire the pipe I was too self-conscious to be seen with in London. Gary and I were both what might be called earnest pipe smokers, with much fiddling inside the bowl and tapping on hard surfaces. It would have been in the crowded staff canteen at lunchtime that we'd have looked our daftest. Two young men in serious suits, both with pitiable moustaches and both smoking pipes with intent. The routine went on for 4 weeks until I saw two women nod in our direction and exchange a smirk. Thomas was ready to go home. He hadn't taken to Toronto. It was, he said, unfriendly and trying too hard to be a Canuck New York with its show-off high-rises and the downtown business types rushing everywhere like their asses were on fire. The long trip back to BC will be done solo, he said, with manufactured cheerfulness. His reconditioned old Ford wouldn't let him down. As Thomas exited through one door, Kip came in through another. It is said that at the intersection of Yonge Street and Bloor in downtown Toronto, you'll eventually meet everyone you've ever known, wherever you knew them. And for Kit and me, it came true. He told me he was based in Toronto writing copy for a New York advertising agency. They rated him so highly he was transferred to the New York headquarters on a 3 month secondment. I told him about my new job. He told me well done, but warned against ruining myself with hippie drugs. I once saw Kit handed a joint, which he inspected as though it was deadly ordnance about to blow, which I suppose it was for Kit. He had read volumes on the destructive fallout from psychoactive substances and was worried not just for me, but for the condition of Western civilization. We exchanged contact details, embraced, and went our separate ways. The next morning, I discovered that the girl who delivered our morning mail and who was too pretty to talk to was called Anita. She looked like Ursula Andress, the long-ago actress famous for emerging from the sea in a white bikini in the first James Bond film. I'd smiled awkwardly at Anita every day for a week, but my legs and my voice wouldn't let me venture closer. Being so pretty, there had to be a boyfriend, I said to Gary. How would the world be if everyone thought like that, he answered. He was right. With shaking hands and a grim demeanour, I asked her to come and see a movie with me. She agreed. 2 nights later, we went to another movie, then to a photographic exhibition and to a pasta restaurant, after which she came home to my apartment and stayed. She was mischievous, funny and sensuous, but also unusually sensitive. She was attuned to elemental forces that pass most people by. The things that frightened her, and there were many, included everyday terrors such as thunder and drowning. Others were unnameable, she said, and usually came at her swooping and flickering when she was alone. What are they like, these forces, I asked. I can't say, she answered. They scare me, but they leave nothing. You're not leaving, she suddenly pleaded. You'll stay with me. We spent more and more nights in the apartment, kissing, holding, and soothing each other. I don't remember letting go before in that way that I did with Anita. At times we clung to each other like climbers scaling a perilous rock face. We would also, on a warm evening after dark, walk or catch the subway somewhere to make love in a place we knew we shouldn't. It was her comedy and her mischief. But while she wanted more and more intensity, more of each other, I wanted to begin breathing my own air again. There were things I had to do outside of what we had. One was having contact with Kit. I invited him round for a Saturday lunch. He and Anita got on well and went on to have semi-regular phone conversations. Another was music. An acoustic guitarist I'd met played the way I dreamed of playing. Wonderful tone, rich transitional chords and runs. He was called Don, and he could fingerpick or use a plectrum to work up hypnotic against the grain rhythms. My guitar playing, by comparison, was barely adequate. Yet even a player like I was can, if he keeps trying, produce something sweetly memorable. I'd been trying since I was 15, writing words and melodies. My copycat Gibson had been with me all the way on my Canadian and American travels, and by some miracle, I got it home safe. I am looking at it now as I write these words. At first, when I got back from visits to Don, Anita would run at me and want to be held, as though my absence had been one of years. Later, resentment crept in, and there'd be silences or tears. The hardest part was when the phone rang at Don's apartment, and it was Anita, for me. I shouldn't be long, no, yes, no, we're just playing a song, we're writing, you know, that kind of thing. No, not long. Look, can we... I had no idea how to deal with what felt like a slow strangulation. I felt feeble and confused. It got worse. There was the night she drank a lot of wine and there'd been no argument, no atmosphere between us, but as I turned from her to walk into the shower, she raked her nails down my back from shoulder to ribs. I felt the blood trickle down, saw it drip onto the tiled floor. I sought counsel from Kit. He advised that I imagine a future with Anita and ask how it was. It was not a future I wanted, but I told him I could never walk out on her. But I did. I slipped away without a word of explanation. Thomas was there on a 3 or 4 day visit. It was while Anita was out of the apartment doing what I can't remember that, as planned, I called Kit, who immediately came over. He said he would explain everything to Anita and be there to support her. I told Thomas, who was lazily rolling a cigarette and filling his coffee cup, that we had to go. We had to go now. It was not my most gallant moment. It pains me even now to think how I ran out on her. But I also learned something. When difficult things need doing, stay and do them. Thomas was driving a vintage Chevy. We tossed a coin when we reached the city outskirts. Heads won, and we went west instead of east to Vancouver Island. There were further adventures I could report, but they reveal nothing new. The essence of those final weeks before returning to London was music, playing, writing, and singing it. Thomas and I were ready to try out what we produced, what was then called soft rock, with the paying public. The worst we could do was fail, and the way back from failure can be the best ride of all.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Back to London. On the way into London from Heathrow, old and broken things look devotedly cared for, unlike in throwaway America. So much faith was vested in sticky tape, glue and paint to hide time's blemishes and to keep what was damaged from falling apart. Road surfaces were a patchwork of black tarmac and weary-looking fences bowed and drooped. England's then patch and mem philosophy might even have been regarded as un-American. America stood for the instantly disposable. Its economy seemed to thrive on it. But it wouldn't be too long before we too would join the club and become addicted to the tiny jolt of gratification that comes with each new purchase. Ringing the doorbell of my mother's Guinness Trust flat was a big moment. I hadn't told them I was coming home, in case something happened that forced a delay. My kid brother, Mitch, now a young man, answered. He was stunned by my sudden appearance after a four-year absence. My mother wiped away tears and said, "Look at you," meaning I was no longer the boy man who left in 1967. She had been convinced, she told me, once the preliminaries were over, that I had died in a massacre of student protesters that happened just 10 days before the start of the 1968 Summer Olympics. She said she wept and grieved through sleepless nights because of my long silence. No letters home following the massacre. I remember reading that student killings were part of the Mexican government's dirty war, aimed at suppressing dissent. Students had gathered in a plaza in Mexico City, thousands of them, determined to make their voices heard. The authorities were just as determined that no group would sour the game's celebratory atmosphere, and in that spirit, soldiers surrounded the plaza. Police and military helicopters flew overhead. Then the firing began. Up to 300 were killed. It's true that my last letter prior to the massacre said that I was getting a bus to Mexico, but it didn't say I was off to Plaza de la Tres Culturas to join with protesting students. "What? Do you want him to turn around and go for another 5 years?" Joe asked my mother. "You were worried too. He hasn't had a cup of tea yet. How do you know he still drinks tea?" "I'll take him to Nan's before you drive him mad." My grandmother had been suffering with her heart for years. She was home from the hospital following a recent mild attack. But it wouldn't be wise to bang on her door and suddenly present myself. Mitch walked ahead and pre-warned her. Before that first coronary, Millie was vibrant, fearless and loud. She would chase after buses she had just missed, cursing the conductor and ordering it to stop. She'd strike up conversations with strangers and soon be asking them to guess her age. The answer would always please her, because the stranger would play safe and knock off 5 or 10 years. After her first heart scare, she began her retreat from the world, explaining that it was to conserve her diminishing vitality so that she might live longer. But I believe it was fear. Her illness robbed her of her confidence to face a world that suddenly looked more perilous. Harry was quieter than Millie. When I was a boy, he seemed to be able to mend anything in the world that was broken. He was a magician. My Canadian friend, Thomas, also had diverse practical skills, and both he and Pop were determined characters to the point of obstinacy. I can see Pop standing up during a family Christmas dinner, holding a wine glass in his hand and marvelling at what they could do with plastic these days. It's not plastic, it's glass, he was told several times. He squeezed it in his fist to show us we were wrong. The glass shattered, and numerous fragments embedded themselves in his palm. Millie and Harry bickered, but they were close. It was a closeness underscored by their tiny dwelling, a one-bedroom cold water flat in which the kitchen table was also the lid of the bath, and the coalman, with a sack of the black stuff on his shoulder, walked past you at tea time through to the tiny space between the kitchen and the toilet and poured his hard, glossy anthracite into the scuttle. Mitch went into Nan and Pop's ahead of me to drumroll my appearance. Pop beamed and did that characteristic wide palm slap of his thigh. Nan was wrapped warmer than had been usual, but I was pleased to see her in a front room armchair rather than in bed. "Let me look at you, darling," she began. "Look how marvellous, like a strong tree. But your old Nan, I've not been well." Her face was thin and the fingers on both hands trembled slightly. But I told her she was still a looker, kissed her and squeezed her hand. She asked if the wig looked nice. It was awful, like a bird had squatted on her head. "You don't need that, Nan," I said. "So what if your hair is thin? It's soft. I like it. It's who you are." Happily, she never wore it again. We were a band with no name, Thomas and his friend from BC, Mickey, who chanced joining our adventure practically as the train was leaving the station, and there was me, the hometown boy. The flat we rented in Muswell Hill, North London, was actually one smallish room, into which were crowded two beds, a sink, with an underpowered water heater, a nasty green plastic breakfast table, and four black padded chairs with slender iron legs. It wasn't gorgeous, but it was cheap. There were buses and a tube nearby, and it was London. "Yee-haw!" screamed Mickey. "Home sweet home," said Thomas. "Hello, London," yelled Mickey. "This is where it starts," said I. We jammed or practiced solo every day for hours while smoking rollies and drinking tea. Mickey was our best player, the only one who could solo convincingly. Thomas could hold a steady rhythm while I threw in some interesting chords and wrote the songs. On the second night, I went for a walk after dark as a light rain fell, threading my way through back streets past illuminated shops, then back into the shadows. I thought about where it had all started and where we had got to. I left London to escape from everything that held me down. In Hyatt Ashbury, it was said that psychic pain is illusionary, a product of ego. And ego is the clown who comes to the front of the stage to receive unearned applause. My path to liberation, Hyatt Ashbury style, would have meant using LSD to strip away the ego defences and go through the death experience before being reborn. I wasn't shy in those days about taking LSD. During one five-day period, while hitchhiking around Southern California, I swallowed a tablet daily with diminishing psychoactive effects, but despite my own reckless disregard for psychological equilibrium, I was deeply mistrustful of those acid high priests, Timothy Leary and co., who urged the willful smashing of ego defences because they were convinced that what lay beneath or what surfaced as a consequence would feel like liberation rather than a colossal a maybe unfixable crisis of confidence. For all that, chaotic Hyatt Ashbury and all that went with it was a weirdly, wonderfully compelling place. We saw ourselves in those days as moving shapes, belonging wherever gravity took us. The old rules, whose purpose was to ensure conformity, meant nothing to us. We were golden, we were stardust. Except we weren't. We were like everybody else. I continued looking for answers to impossible questions, but for the here and now it was music. It always was music from the moment my own generation found its voice. Music carried us along, changed as we changed, spoke to us and for us, and set us free. Our Anglo-Canadian band didn't have a name yet, but we did have a roadie, with three marketable virtues. He got us and our equipment to where we were supposed to be and back again. He knew which end of a screwdriver was up, and he was enthusiastic about the group and its music. He was my kid brother Mitch, who at the time was working for a vending machine company as a delivery driver, and therefore had out-of-hours access to a dark red Morris 1000 van. Our very first gig was in a pub called the Queen's Head, a five-minute drive from our rented room. It was a grubby, brassy-looking joint whose golden rule was, turn the volume down if a light above the bar starts flashing. My fingers readied themselves for the opening chord of a cheerless number I wrote called Winter Comes. It was our first song of our first proper gig, but instead of a mellow D minor augmented, there was a scream, a feedback, a bang, and then nothing. We were novices, but we immediately had to learn the art of looking untroubled in the midst of a bewildering catastrophe. It took 15 minutes to identify a loose razor blade inside the amp as the source of our big bang. Our boozy, sympathetic audience soon settled. They even showed signs of enjoying a set that was 50% written and arranged by us, and the rest by musical champions of the day, Joni Mitchell, John Lennon, Paul Simon, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Neil Young. After a couple more Queen's Head gigs, I concluded that we three Anglo-Canadians, for all our zeal and passion for the form, the 2 a.m. rehearsals and the keen study of proper musicians, were never going to be more than pleasingly average. There is no harm done with that. Some people don't wish to be startled by genius. They prefer things placid and reassuringly ordinary. We were what we were, competent but unremarkable guitarists. As the lead vocalist, I hit the right notes. My songwriting never reached Randy Newman levels, but it gave pleasure, even solace, to some. Just as I was getting comfortable with the idea of living with mediocrity, we were offered 2 nights at the very well-regarded King's Head Theatre and Pub in Islington. In fact, Dan Crawford's King's Head was revolutionary. Crawford invented pub theatre and later threw in live music to enrich the experience. He began in 1970 with borrowed money. We played during 1971 and were probably among the first groups he took on. So it was Rattigan, Stoppard and Coward out back and the Anglo-Canadians out front where the bar was, trying to play and sing with robust joy but needing to keep it down so that the actors could hear themselves. I read recently that Crawford's enterprise revolutionised shows in the capital and that the careers of performers such as Anthony Scher, Victoria Wood, Stephen Berkoff, Hugh Grant and Quentin Crisp were nurtured at the little venue. Dozens of its productions transferred to the West End and 6 moved to Broadway. I remember Dan, who died in 2005, as a sweet contemplative type, but also fierce when a rowdy drunk needed attention. The King's Head gig lasted 5 or 6 months. We had little other work and so money was tight, but we could always be guaranteed food and a drink on the house at a health food shop and cafe called Living Earth, just down the road from the King's Head. It was run by a woman who was plagued by ill health, the ailments. I like to think having prompted her to start a business rather than her business being the cause of them. My brother Mitch reminds me of a melancholy visit we paid her in a sickbed one evening. We found there, in the dust and jumble of clothes strewn on the floor, something of Dickens's Miss Havisham. We would noodle away on our guitars in the main part of the cafe, trying our material that might later make our set. But the real musician in the place, a diminutive singer in whose background there was some awful trauma about which she wouldn't talk about, but which was the subject of much speculation. Danielle would always be sure to enter with some flamboyance, trailing a silk or chiffon scarf and in tight-fitting calf-high leather boots. And there would always, but always, be a man a step or two behind carrying her guitar. The duty when we were there went to a wholesaler of novelty sex toys called Vance. What I mostly remember is that when the urge came upon Daniel to unzip her guitar case and sing, we knew we were listening to someone operating at an entirely different level The strong, distinctive voice was equal to that of the likes of, going back some years, Brenda Lee, Loretta Lynn and Patsy Cline. Why would this immense talent be singing at this funny health shop, we would ask ourselves? But then, why were any of us there? We lasted longer than I would imagined at the King's Head, something of a prestige venue. Were we any good? I asked Mitch. You were a proper group, he said. People listened and they liked it. And you got applause. In fact, we got more than that. I looked up from my fretboard one evening into the King's Head audience and saw a young man to my right singing along with me to a song I had written. And he knew all the words. It was extraordinary and quite a wonderful experience. I now know how Freddie Mercury felt when he brought the house down at the 1985 Live Aid concert. Well, almost.
That was My Life as an Animal by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith. Produced by Tom Davidson and adapted for UK Health Radio by Monkey Nut Audiobooks. My Life as an Animal is available on Audible and audiobook sites. Be sure to tune in next time to hear more from this title. This audiobook is published by Monkey Nut Audiobooks in Hampshire, UK.